Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by Jack Spencer, Mike Malott, Jacob Kanzler, and our special guest this week, Frank Houston, former Democratic Party Chair for Oakland County. A little later, we're going to talk to the president of the Michigan Education Association, that's Paula Herbart. But first, a lot happened this past week in Oakland County, and that's why we invited you to come in, Frank. Were you proud to be a Oakland County Democrat Friday at about, 2 o'clock in the afternoon after the new executive had been selected for the county?
Well, I think the short answer is yes, Kyle, and thanks for having me. I'm very proud to have David Coulter as our county executive. I think he'll be great. But it was a messy week. It reminded me, I think it was actually the day before Brooks's funeral. My wife was out of town. We have 6 kids, and I'm trying to keep the peace in my house. And, you know, I'm like, let's do family movie night. And my 6-year-old yells out, I want Aquaman. My 9-year-old wanted Book of Life. And then, like, along the way, my 2-year-old's like, I love this movie. I hate this movie. My 11-year-old's like, can I leave the room for tablet time? My 4-year-old's yelling something else. And finally, I'm like, no electronics ever again if we can't resolve this movie. And my 2-year-old's like, what are we even fighting for? You know, over. And my 6-year-old looks up. He's like, all right, we can watch Book of Life. We all like it. It's fine. And I think that's kind of how this all looks. I'm sorry for the bad analogy, but that's what it felt like.
I'm just
like
thinking you just got a lot of kids.
We do. But you know what? In Oakland County the last few weeks, it probably felt like that as well. So it's
So you have a 2-year-old who's already a movie critic?
I don't know about a critic. He said he loved all of them, hated all the movies. But he was he brought it back with the focusing question of what are we fighting over? And I think in Oakland County, I think that's what got lost for a week or two. And you know what? I mean, no one replaces a Brooks Patterson. I mean, for all of our differences on party lines and approach to issues, et cetera, I mean, you can't replace Brooks. You can just move forward. And I think, and I'll say this, I think David as county executive is well positioned for that. I think it'd be hard to find a Democrat or Republican who could say he's not qualified, a smart guy who's good to work with. I think Brooks would have said the same thing candidly from their time working together a decade ago more. But yeah, I mean, the reality is when you lose someone like that, you know, obviously the staff had a certain loyalty to him that's completely understandable. Emotions are going to run high. And you have a couple Democrats and David Woodward and Andy Meiser who are obviously hoping to be the next county executive who had to put ego aside in the end. You know, that's tough. So it's understandable why it was a tough couple weeks, but I think in the end we have someone that all of Oakland County can be proud of.
Do you think that rises to the level of what you could call a debacle or just heading off a debacle?
That's a tough one. I'll say there was debacle moments, but I think we've headed it off before it mattered. I mean, in the end, there is no appointment process with this much politics and this much at stake that isn't going to be borderline debacle. But the reality is when it came time to appointing a new executive, we did it within 30 days, and we've got someone that's very competent. I think we'll make Oakland County proud.
I can see Republicans saying, you know, if you want more of what happened this summer, you know, don't vote Dem. How do you kind of get ahead of kind of what just happened to kind of prevent that from spilling over into 2020?
I candidly can't picture this being an election issue in 20, the appointment process, which, by the way, was the legal appointment process, which is whoever's in a majority in the county commission is probably going to pick the next county executive. To me, it reminds me of like when we went through redistricting a decade ago, and candidly, Republicans changed the redistricting process to protect a Republican majority through gerrymandering. I mean, voters in the end, I don't think lean in that heavily into issues of inside baseball, of how appointment processes work and, you know, what Democrat or Republican said and what the text message to who. I mean, like, this is such inside baseball that all of us might get charged up about and enjoy speculating on. I think voters are going to be paying attention. Is County Executive Coulter keeping Oakland County a responsible fiscal path? Are we collaborating with other key decision makers in the region in a way that moves Oakland County forward? And God knows there's going to be other challenges that the county executive is going to face that, you know, David Coulter is going to have to prove he's up for the challenge on. And regardless if he runs for re-election or not, that's going to reflect on Democrats because in the end we made the call of who the leader should be.
So I'm just doing a little checklist here and kind of piggybacking off Jacob's question. So we had a few missteps here. We had Dave Woodward resigning when he didn't have the votes for executive after he resigned. The selection process, the Democrats picked somebody who wasn't even part of the interview process. And then the all this process was going while Brooks was being laid to rest, and one of the meetings was scheduled during Brooks's funeral until it got moved. So in light of all this, it looks like the Democrats being in charge maybe for the first time in a long time made a bit of a dog's lunch out of this. How can this not be brought up during the election?
I just think it's not what – well, let me be honest. Yes, there's some mistakes. And some of them I think were overblown. For instance, the meeting being scheduled on Brooks' funeral, that was scheduled before Brooks died, just to be very clear.
Okay. All right.
So that meeting was actually scheduled, I think, a year ago. So when they initially were setting the calendar, it was before Brooks' death. And it wasn't rescheduled maybe in the most sensitive manner. But at the same point, once Brooks' funeral was set, the meeting was moved for that reason. So I think some of these missteps are a little bit twisted or overblown. But I'll go back to the same point I said a minute ago. Oakland County voters are going to care about how is the county run? Do we still have our AAA bond rating? Are we developing the county and repositioning us economically with all the other factors at stake? Are we in the middle of a recession at the time? How are we working with Detroit versus in odds with Detroit when it comes to jobs and the future of manufacturing and all these other issues that are going to touch the region? So I think those are the issues people are going to care about. I don't think they're going to care if one of the steps in the process were as clean as we'd like. I mean, in the end, they followed the law, they appointed a county exec, and they pounded someone that I think everyone's going to be pretty damn proud of.
Did the new executive down there on that basis try to keep as many of the Patterson people in place, at least for a while, if this is important to have this continue to run somewhat as it's been running in the past?
Well, I would have said a week ago, yes, generally. I mean, this is a simplified answer, but I think it's a little more nuanced than that. I mean, I think there's some folks there that, and I'm not saying anything about their competency or anything like that. I think Brooks has been proven, his team there, the execs from Jerry to Poison on down, have proven to be competent at their jobs. But I think, some of them, it might be the time that they want to step away. And, obviously several of them offered their resignation last week during this process. So I don't think they should be shown the door, in any sort of inadvertent manner. But I do think that, some folks may be looking to move on or retiring now that Brooks is gone. I think a lot of them obviously stayed there for years because of Brooks. So I think it's going to be up to the county executive Coulter now to put together a management team very quick. 10 days, I think, is the rule, if I remember right, to appoint the deputies. I do hope some of them stay, and I hope David gives them serious consideration, which I expect him to. But I also think that it's important that if they stay on, they have to acknowledge that they're not just there to hold down Brooks's vision moving forward, but it's to incorporate the things that David and I think Democrats have offered before to the county in terms of more regional collaboration, more aggressive look at how we make sure the southern part of the county is represented in fiscal matters as well as the northern part of the county. What do we do with regional transit? How do we have a vision for the future of automotive manufacturing as one example? I mean, there's a lot of issues that David may have a different take than Brooks. So I think it's important that the executive team that stays on, that he chooses, is ready to support that vision. But I would expect some to stay. I would hope so.
And so does Coulter run next year to retain that seat? Do you think he should?
Well, I think the short answer is that's a question for David, not me. But in my personal opinion, I think he needs to focus on running the county right now. Number one, I mean, we've got the deputy appointments and a budget, all that need to be done within a month, roughly. So if I was him, I mean, personally, I'd recommend that the next couple months he focus on getting a handle for the job and doing the job. I think that's the most important thing. And it's not just the right thing to do. It's also the thing that's going to build confidence if he wants to run for re-election. And the second, but in my personal opinion, if he does a good job, which I expect David to, I hope he runs. And I think he should run. I mean, candidly, I think it would have been foolish for the Democratic majority on the county commission to appoint someone who couldn't position themselves to be a good county executive moving forward after the election. Now, whether or not David wants to do that, whether or not it makes sense to Oakland County voters, that remains to be seen. But my expectation is David's going to do a great job, and my hope is that he'll run again if he does.
A lot has been made about the split within Oakland County Democrats between Dave Woodward, the chair of the county commission, and treasurer Andy Meisner. How deep is that division?
It's hard for me to say from the sidelines, but I think, obviously tensions were running pretty hot the last couple weeks because both were, for years, have been active in Oakland County politics, working for Oakland County voters. And both are smart, talented, ambitious guys. So it's gonna, when there's a position that clearly both have wanted for a while, it's hard. And I'll say, like, you know, going back to my analogy with my kids, like, it was my 6-year-old eventually, like, hey, we can just watch Book of Life because everyone likes that movie in our household. Like, that kind of, in a way, that kind of how I look at Dave. Like, I think he showed a lot of integrity here at the end. He put aside his ambition. He put aside, I mean, you could argue parts of his vision for where maybe the county would go forward and his political future by saying, like, you know what? I'll take a step back and I'll support David Coulter for exec. When you do that, If you're Dave Woodward, you're acknowledging that if Dave Coulter runs for re-election, you're probably not running against him. I mean, I'll let Dave say that, but it makes it hard for him to run against him if Coulter runs for re-election. So I give Dave some props for that. And I think it's rare that I think politicians in this position can keep in mind like what's best for the county as well, and, you know, to some degree our party, but it so anyway, so I, in terms of how deep the fissure was with him and Andy, it's hard to say. I mean, this has been a tough couple weeks for Andy as well. I don't necessarily agree with everything he did along the way. But once again, you know, it was a hard time. I mean, just like it's been hard for the Republicans. And the one other thing I'd say is, like, when you look at any of the missteps that have happened here, any of the tensions, think about always if the roles were reversed, how people would act. So, for instance, if Andy had had the votes on the county commission from the Democratic side, would he have said, let's step away and not appoint a longer-term executive? Would the Republicans have said, if they were in the majority still in the county commission, let's not appoint who we want to be our future county executive, and said, let's just put a placeholder Democrat in? You know, these are things that I think it's important to keep in mind as we think about people's integrity and how they think we should move forward.
All the years that Brooks was there, and I'll use the phrase, he probably would have disagreed with it somewhat, as far as blocking the transit issue. Was he bucking the Oakland County voters when he did that, or was he representing their sentiments, do you think?
I think it's a mixed bag. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of voters in Oakland County who not just want but need better regional transit. You know, for instance, State Senator Lucido on the way in, I was hearing him talking about the need for transit as a way of helping, you know, balance out a road plan to fix the damn roads. So I don't think it's just Democrats, and I don't think it's just Oakland County voters. I think, but there's a lot of people who need regional transit more and a better system than we've got. But also, there's some folks who frankly don't need it or don't want it, probably rather have their tax dollars spent somewhere else. And I think that's what, you know, people like, you know, former County Executive Patterson and others, that's why they're in the position there, is to balance those interests and think about what's best for the region. Do I disagree with Brooks's way of handling it? Absolutely. I live in Royal Oak. I've lived there for over a decade, and I can see the pros and cons of investing in 75. But, you know, and when you look at that, the amount of money we're spending on expanding I-75 versus the impact regional transit would have had, I think it's clear cut. Transit probably would have been a better use of dollars. But
is there a trust factor involved there too, with the other county execs involved?
Well, I think the other county executives, when I've seen, respected Brooks and his, you know, position on it. Just like I expect moving forward, you know, there'll be a common respect from the counties and the city on this. But it's in the end of the day, it's going to be about, I think, people taking a hard look at how we move the region forward, because we can't go back to the days of just fighting for our own fiefdoms. Anywhere in this state, anywhere in this country, you do that. I don't care if you're talking about school boards or city councils or county governments or states. The more we deny the interdependence we have on each other, the higher likelihood we're all going to go down.
You're live here in MERS World Headquarters, so you have a good look at the board, where MERS is embarked once again on its who is the next to drop contest among our staff and contributors. And we started this a couple, well, I guess now it had been 4 years ago when the Republican field was massive. Mm-hmm. And we all put in our names of who we thought was the next to go. And I partially bring this up just to brag, because I got the first one right in Hickenlooper, and it will probably be the only one I get right the whole rest of the year. So I got to go ahead and get that in there. But we have all sorts of names on the board here as the next to drop. We got Governor Bullock, de Blasio, Tim Ryan's my pick, Bennett. We do got one Kirsten Gillibrand. We've got some of these odd, this Meesum guy, Moulton. So we've got a whole bunch of people on here. So, Frank, if you had to put a name on the board, what would your name be?
I don't know if mine's up there or not. And you know, I might say Moulton. That's just off the top of my head.
Jacob's celebrating because I just picked Moulton.
I'd like to stick with smart people, so I'll stick with Jacob on this one. But but I think it's a political crapshoot. I mean, to be honest, I think each of these guys have to, and women, excuse me, need to look closely at, you know, do they have a credible shot? Are they advancing a clear issue set that necessitates they stay in to make sure those issues are heard? And, you know, I think the broader political realities just kind of kick in. I mean, you know, these donor and polling numbers are pretty hard to stay relevant without hitting those thresholds. So for the folks that aren't on track to hit that for the next debate cycle, it begs the question, are you an issue candidate and then maybe you stay in? Or are you positioning yourself trying to broaden your support for a future run for something else, be it Senate short term or something 4 to 6 years down the road? So I think it's hard to say, but I'll stick with Jacob and Moulton for now.
So what are you hearing on the ground among Oakland County activists in regards to this presidential race? What's kind of sticking in your head as they're looking at these candidates in this massive field and how they're weeding through this?
Well, I think I think Democrats are proud of the field. I mean, we have a lot of really talented people that are running, and people are excited, I mean, about the field. I think it's also, there's something for everyone. And I think if there's a couple thematic things that I'm hearing, it's people like the stability of Joe Biden. It's not that he's like, oh, he can just go after working class Democrats in the Midwest and talk to those steel workers downriver from Detroit or auto workers in Macomb County. It's not just that. I think he has a proven track record, you know, some missteps along the way, like any elected official with his track record. But I think people like his stability. And then I think the other thing people are looking for is that not just bold vision of, you know, kind of lefty change, but I think just the energy and the policy expertise and a vision for where to take on tough issues and in how to lead the country forward. So that's where, like, you know, like an Elizabeth Warren stands out to people. Or, I mean, even like I was at the debates and the second day, the not just like some of the one-liners, but the energy of a Cory Booker came through. And I'm not saying he's going to be the nominee by any means based on his polling numbers, but I think Democrats are looking for someone who's energetic, who's got good ideas, and a track record of getting some things done in tough circumstances, and someone who, even if they might not agree with Republicans on all the issues, regardless of how liberal we are or not, I think they want to see someone who's going to try to unite the country and work together with people when they can. And so that's what, so I, you know, like that's the type of themes I'm hearing. It's like they want someone who's got energy and ideas, who's not just going to rest on their career, but they also like someone who's got a proven track record. And I think we have candidates that kind of encompass all those things.
Frank Houston, former chair of the Oakland County Democratic Party. Thanks for joining us on the podcast. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Okay, and before we get to our interview here with MEA President Paula Herbart, Mike, you were in Austin, Texas this past week for ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. And this is traditionally a think tank type organization, a coalition of mostly Republican legislators who get together and kind of maybe bounce around different subject areas and policies and so forth, or maybe it's more a bit top down. Some might argue that.
Pretty sure it was all Republican.
So why don't you give our listeners a little bit of a snapshot of what you saw down there?
Well, it was blatantly partisan. It is very clear that this was all conservative lawmakers compared to NCSL, which at least purports to be bipartisan. And the conservative lawmakers who were at ALEC would say that the Democrats have taken over NCSL, but there was no bones about the fact that ALEC is very conservative, and they write a lot of model policies that are intended to be the conservative take on whatever the issue of the day is. There were protests. We, of course, wrote a story about the one protest that was out on the street.
There was a protest inside the actual hotel in Austin.
Well, I think there was. I heard chanting, and I went to go see where the chanting was, and by the time I got to where I thought the chanting was coming from, the protester was gone. I only heard one voice shouting out, "Shame on ALEC! Shame on ALEC!" And by the time I got there, that person was gone. And of course, I asked around and nobody knew anything. But then security increased, or it seemed to me. I saw a lot of people that looked like Secret Service with the heavy earpiece, plainclothes and heavy earpiece. But you can almost understand that if people are infiltrating the hotel to try to disrupt this conference, it makes sense that now the security is going to go up. So it was interesting indeed. And like I said, very conservative. But I never had a situation where I couldn't get into a session that I wanted to go into. Anytime that I was asked for my credentials, they let me into whatever session. One of the most controversial sessions was on redistricting. It was clear that that is a national issue, and the very fact that Alec was going to have this workshop had already been attacked in the progressive press, and yet they were very, I got into that session very easily, and I noticed other reporters were there.
So you rode down to, you flew down to Austin, Texas, and who was on your plane?
I thought I knew about half the people on the plane. Lee Chatfield was on the plane. Rob Menard was on the commuter to Detroit, from Lansing to Detroit, but I didn't see him on the flight from Detroit to Austin. On the flight from Detroit to Austin, it was Lee Chatfield, Eric Lighthizer, Mike Weber, Doug Wozniak. In Austin, I came across Pauline Wenzel, Andrea Schroeder. I never saw Sarah Leitner, but I understand that she was there.
Steve Johnson.
Steve Johnson gave me a good interview that I still haven't written up. It was like drinking from a fire hose down there.
They could have had a caucus down there, it sounds like.
Well, Julie Alexander and I joked about the very thing.
You mentioned something that was really interesting, that there was a religious element there that maybe you wouldn't expect at, like you mentioned, NCSL, the National Conference of State Legislatures. Tell me about that.
In my attendance of NCSL, I saw nothing religious. But at ALEC, the first day luncheon, there was a prayer. The president of ALEC, sorry, I'm not remembering his name, led the entire luncheon in a prayer at a session regarding how you frame your message to make your message more effective. There were references in there from an author who wrote a book on how to frame your message. Several references to religion and to God-given rights in that. And then between sessions, I came across a prayer session out in the hallway, which was interesting.
Prayer session in the hallway?
It was three, four guys had their hands on each other's shoulders. I was pretty sure that somebody had done something really bad and they were praying for him the way it looked to me.
Okay.
Maybe not, because nobody slinked away in shame, but it was interesting that there was a prayer session out in the hallway among these guys. It was religious in ways that I simply have not seen at a political event before.
Well, thanks for that update, Mike, and I'm glad that you made it back and didn't melt in the 103-degree heat of Austin, Texas. You look cool and composed today.
I went down there, and it was 74 degrees when I left here. It was 103 when we landed. On Thursday night, it rained. It was a thunderstorm, and it cooled the outside temperatures off 20 degrees. It went from 94 degrees. This is after the sun goes down. It went from 94 degrees after the sun went down to 74 degrees. And at this point, I'm going, okay, I can go outside now. I'm going to explore the town. Within an hour, it was back up to 94 degrees. Don't know whether that was the ground radiating heat or an air mass moving in, but after the sun went down, the temperature went back up 20 degrees. So I just said, okay, I'm kind of done with Austin here.
All right. Well, cool. Thanks for that, that update. Joining us now for the podcast is the president of the Michigan Education Association, Paula Herbart. Thanks for joining us on the podcast this week.
Thank you for having me, Kyle. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk with you.
So with so much going on in education right now in the state, what is the number one thing that concerns you the most about this upcoming budget that the legislature and the governor are likely going to be putting together after Labor Day? What is it that you are really worried is going to happen as a part of this?
Well, thanks for the question. You know, the biggest concern for us is to ensure funding for public schools. As always, you know, we care about what happens in the classroom, and the governor has proposed $500 million in the budget for public school. We're thrilled about that. We've been backing that plan. We're excited about making sure that our students get everything that they need. Part of what she's done is the blended formula, which is great, ensuring that students who have less access to opportunity have more funding. Those students with special needs have more funding. All of these things are so vital to our public school funding. The School Collaborative has talked about that. And at Launch Michigan, we've also talked about making sure that our students have everything that they need. And this budget offers that for our students, the opportunity to fill those gaps.
So you're more concerned about making sure you're getting the funding than whatever the legislature's thinking about in terms of the teacher retirement system and possibly bonding money against the teacher retirement system.
We want to make sure that the governor's plan is put through with fidelity. You talk about bonding the pensions. You talk about amortizing our pensions. We're not for that. That's a scheme. That's a real gamble that could cost billions of dollars to taxpayers in the future, and we can't have that. We're excited about the opportunity for the governor's proposal to come across and have all of the state leaders come together and understand that we need good infrastructure for the state of Michigan. We need good financial infrastructure for the schools. But pensions for potholes, that's not the way to do it.
What are you hearing from your members right now as far as what they're here or what are they feeling the state is doing for them or doing to them as educators?
Well, we're excited about the school year coming up, but not having a budget really hurts school districts all across the state. We've got 2 or 3 weeks. We've already got teachers in session right now. We've got teachers going to school, getting ready for their students. And the legislature should be doing the same thing, getting ready to get their financial house together. And we need to make sure that the governor's budget gets passed the way that we want it to ensure that our students get everything that they need and that we're continuing to work hard for a strong system for all of Michigan students.
What are you hearing from your teachers in terms of the school start date? The school year is going to be right around the corner. It's already started maybe for some districts. What are they telling you as far as the waivers and so forth? Because it seems like there's more and more schools that are starting before Labor Day and getting those waivers from the Department of Ed.
Well, our teachers are prepared at any time of the day to go to school, and they can't wait to get back into their classrooms. Our educators, whether they're a paraprofessional, whether they're a bus driver, they're ready to start. One of the things that helps with this, having the flexibility, is that local communities get to decide what's best for their schools. And teachers and educators play a role in that calendar building and are hopeful that with these waivers that they can get exactly what that district needs to ensure that they are able to serve their students the best in that community.
As far as the policy angle on the state legislative level, is there anything in particular you're concerned about that is being done at the legislative level or something in particular you'd like to see them do?
Well, you know, passing the budget will be great for us. I can't say it enough, and I'm not afraid to talk about it. You know, we could use that $500 million to ensure that students get all of the things that they need, school libraries, counselors, social work. With all the violent activity that we've seen throughout the summer, we get concerned for our students, and we want to ensure that the money is there to support them with nurses and educators who are prepared for anything that come their way. We really need to make sure that our schools have the funding that they deserve to ensure that our students are getting everything that they need to be successful.
Are you comfortable with Proposal A?
Well, Proposal A was passed when I was first an educator in the 1990s. And, you know, it's a system that's come and gone. It hasn't been done with any real fidelity. If we had done Proposal A with some fidelity, with cost of living increases and all of the things that they said that they would do, include full funding of the school aid fund, then maybe it would have been okay. But unfortunately, it hasn't done the job that we needed it to do. And what Governor Whitmer's plan does is fill in the gaps of those things that we know we so richly actually deserve. The School Finance Collaborative has come out with things. The MSU work that was done by Dr. David Arnson also says, listen, we haven't funded our schools the way that they've needed to be. We're a decade behind in school funding, and we need to make up for that.
So do you think that Proposal A needs to be changed at all, or are you comfortable with operating within the confines of Proposal A?
Well, I think that our school funding needs to be fully funded. We've raided the school aid fund for years and years and years to pay for other things like the infrastructure. If we could get the revenue that we need to ensure that our infrastructure, our roads are safe and secure, you know, we have thousands and thousands of buses that travel on Michigan roads and bridges. We have hundreds of thousands of students that travel via bus. We need to make sure that that infrastructure is sound and secure, but you can't do that by robbing Peter to pay Paul. And that's what we've been doing under Prop A, and that can't continue to happen.
How do you think Betsy DeVos has done as the Department of Ed Secretary?
I think that Betsy DeVos isn't an educator, and if she were, she would have thought twice about 1,000 different plans. But one thing that I can tell you is that her policies haven't helped the public education sector, and it hasn't helped us here in Michigan. We fought against Betsy DeVos's proposals for vouchers in public schools. Those things don't work. It drains the public schools of our funding. What will work in Michigan will be the plan that Governor Whitmer has to have the proposal where we increase our funding by $500 million by ensuring and securing funding for our roads with a dedicated revenue stream and ensuring that the money that is in the school aid fund stays in the school aid fund, and we're able to increase that by $500 million.
When I've talked to teachers in years past, they've told me that their biggest frustration is that they feel like Lansing is imposing more and more and more mandates and different requirements for them. Do you feel like the legislators have finally gotten the message that they need to ease back a little bit and let the learning happen at the local level?
I think our legislators are willing to listen. I've had an open door policy with both Senator Shirky and with House Leader Lee Chatfield. I've been lucky to have conversations with them, and all of legislators have been great about bringing educators to the table. But we've fought hard for that. We've ensured that our voices have been a part of the narrative. Launch Michigan helps to be a part of that, and we're excited about the opportunity to say, if you're going to do anything that has anything to do with making sure that educators are more successful, ask an educator exactly what they need, and they'll tell you. And this funding stream that the governor has proposed, in no small measure, will help encourage that to really happen.
Do you have any concerns about the third grade reading mandates that are going to be coming down, I think, with this coming class, right?
Right. They will. That's a great question, Kyle. One of the things that we know is that we need to have supports in place for those students who aren't making the grade. And currently, we don't have the finances to ensure that those supports are in place, like extra paraeducators who can help support the learning in the classroom, like a literacy coach that can help those teachers who aren't as strong in the teaching of reading and writing. Maybe their major is in math and science, and they aren't reading specialists. That literacy coaches can help those teachers be the best that they can be, strategizing with educators on how to best service children, because reading discrepancies aren't just one cause. It could be three causes, five causes. It could be a language barrier. It could be dyslexia. It could be a learning disability. And we have to address those individuals individually, and that costs money. And we need to make sure that the funding is there to ensure that these young, fragile students are able to have the supports that they need, and their teachers have the supports that they also need to make sure that they can give them everything that they deserve and need to have in order to be successful.
Last week, we ran a story in MERS coming out of the NCSL conference, the National Conference of State Legislators, and one of the speakers stressed that the biggest issue going forward for our society in general is early education, 0 to 3, 0 to 4, and that's how you can keep an educated, talented workforce, try and get people away from the criminal justice system. Do you feel like that's a message that's gotten out and has sunk in with our elected leaders?
Well, I'm hopeful. You know, in Launch Michigan, we're having discussions about our pre-K and K. You know, in Michigan, we don't have compulsory kindergarten.
Right.
If we had one of the key indicators for graduation is whether or not a child went to kindergarten.
I can't believe there's still people who don't go to, kids who have not gone to kindergarten. That's
right.
Amazing.
And it's also not compulsory to have it be full day necessarily. So we have kindergarten. Pre-K is vital. What is the number one indicator that a child will not be truant? If they went to kindergarten. Starting school early shows that they build a rapport of getting up and going to school. If they don't have that in their habit and they're not used to that, that's one of the ways that we can identify whether or not a student will be truant or not.
And then I also wanted to ask about what the impact of Right to Work has had on MEA. We're a few years into Right to Work, and obviously there's been some questions, how many people you've lost and so forth. Have you felt the impact of Right to Work?
I think the whole state has felt the impact of Right to Work from the private sector, the public sector. And one of the things that we know here is we need to better serve and communicate to our members what the MEA does for them. We represent over 125,000 people in the state of Michigan. We have members in every county in the state of Michigan. And what we know is that for them, the membership in MEA is more relevant than ever to fight the needs for social justice, for equity in funding for our students, to ensure that the safety and security of our students and our educators are frontmost in the minds of legislators. That's the impact, is that we have really gone out, listened to our members, and made sure that what they need from the MEA, we're providing them.
You mentioned Launch Michigan a couple times in just speaking with us. Tell me about why that's been important and why that coalition has been very important to pushing forward your message.
Well, it's an unprecedented coalition with business leaders, community and philanthropic leaders, labor and education leaders. It's so important that we get everyone together, anyone who has a stake in educating a child, come together and solve problems together. For over a decade, we've allowed the legislature to do a top-down approach, and it really hasn't helped our students succeed. So what we're saying is, let's get the community, everyone who has a stake in a child's education, come together and work to solve problems to ensure that we, with one voice, can say to legislators, we believe this is what's best for our students. And you know what? We listened to educators. They were a part of the table. We've listened to labor and management and education. They've been a part of the conversation. We've listened to the community leaders, the philanthropic leaders. We know what's important to them. And business leaders have been able to tell us what's important for an educated child to have once they come out of high school. These are so key indicators for the success of the state of Michigan that we know that this collaboration can have such a great impact on what happens for the future of the state of Michigan and for our students.
It seems like it also takes away partisan labels from anything as well, because this ends up being, it seems like, a bipartisan group and almost like the Problem Solvers Caucus, maybe on the congressional level, maybe a local derivative of that.
Well, education, as I've always said, is a nonpartisan issue. All of our children go to school. All of our children need things from our public schools. All of our children need to feel and be successful. And it doesn't matter whether you have an R behind your name, a D, an L, an I. These children need everything, every opportunity to succeed. And Launch Michigan is here to work to that end.
Paula Herbart, she is the president of the Michigan Education Association. Thanks for taking so much time with us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Kyle. I really appreciate it. Have a great day.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of MERS Monday. Thanks to Frank Houston for making the trip up here. Paula Herbart for taking some time with us earlier. And just, Mike, I'm just going to take a wild stab here. Was that happened to be Bo LaFave who called at about the four-minute mark of the podcast?
Yes, indeed. It was Bo. But why do you ask?
Well, because I got a text from Bo while we were at minute 3, and so then he called me and then he called you. I bet you he's got a hot tip. Or does he have a Quote of the Day nominee? Which one do you think it is?
I think he's going for Quote of the Day because he really likes to bid for Quote of the Day.
I think his goal is to get more Quotes of the Day this year than Dana Nessel. And if he succeeds at that, it will be a banner year for Bo LaFave.
I think it's a three-way competition between those two and Jeremy Moss.
Mm. That's right. But Jeremy Moss is okay to throw down support for Dana Nessel, though.
Well,
he said that on Twisted.
He said that before.
Yeah.
So, it's not unusual for a lot of people to have numerous quotes of the day in any given year. It's like, you know, getting reelected is important too. But other than that, getting quote of the day ranks pretty high.
Well, especially if you can get the most quotes of the day of the year, which tend to be like the governor because they're quoted the most. But because of Twitter, I mean, that used to be the case like, let's say, 10 years ago, right, Jack? I mean, the governor seemed to get the most amounts of quotes of the day because we quoted him or her the most. But now with Twitter, there's so many quips that get out there that at the end of the day, if there's not a real good quote in the edition, I'll just go to Twitter and see who had the most likes or hearts or retweets or whatever that is. And
it's
go ahead
and
use that.
It's a complicated scientific method that is used for quote of the day.
Oh, it's yeah. Yeah, all you got to do is text me, and if I like it, then I...
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, well, sometimes, though, I do punt to the proofers, though. Or I'll ask somebody else to choose if I'm torn between a couple.
Oh, that's disappointing, because I send them in all the time, you know, and I think, well, maybe this one will get it. So it's not even you necessarily. No,
you take nominations.
But you realize every time you get... As a reporter, you are the one who sent in the quote. That person to you who got it is always sort of, you know, a little bit, shall we say, they talk to you a little more often afterward.
Yeah, there's always that benefit.
I liked your approach during Lame Duck, where you just kind of threw it out on the floor of the house and let people respond to which quote of the day was the best. And, you know, we got a lot of feedback.
Well, when we had like three or four real good options, I mean, that was the best way to go. But in the dog days of summer, sometimes it's whoever gets 10 retweets on Twitter that rises to the top, which isn't necessarily the best thing, I guess.
Yeah, that's just always unfortunate on a good quote of the day that three or four get wasted.
I know. It's really bad.
And then the next day, you know, it's dead and pass the salt will work. It's the quote of the day.
And then
I mean, it feels like a waste of good quotes of the day. So should we change it to quote of the week so that we can use yesterday's quotes that may be better than today's quotes?
Well, what we can always do is we can have the person who said it yesterday say it again the next day. That's all. And sometimes we can package them. So sometimes these quotes of the day can be standalones, and if they're not like really out there publicly, sometimes people will let us like just kind of put them in the fridge.
And then we can... quote of the day, it's not real anyway, let's be honest. So.
Hey, no, it's real to us, though. I mean, it's our calling card.
No, that's what I'm saying. Until you get quote of the day, have you really said it?
Ooh, that's a good one.
That's right.
It's like when the tree falls in the woods and no one is there to hear
exactly.
It. Did it make a sound? That's very good. All right, so anyway.
Very philosophical.
I'm contemplating great thoughts now.
So now that we've given away our secret formula here on how you get quotes of the day, I'm sure my phone will blow up, and then yours is going to blow up in our next podcast with people who's got all sorts. Yeah, right. Everybody's got great ideas. Not recommended, or we'll have to turn our phones off next time. I don't know. But anyway, thank you, AT&T, for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts, and Jack, Mike, and Jacob. Until next week, I'm Kyle Malin. Take care.